I want to say hello to everyone and welcome them to Lighted Pathways premiere of our Relationship Enhancement Series. I am Jenny Olin, a licensed clinical social worker and owner of Lighted Pathways in Saratoga Springs, New York, where I specialize in relationship counseling and education and helping people create healthy relationships for life. And today's program is Trust Issues on the Rise in Couples Relationships. Joining us is our expert, Dr. Joe Bavanese, who with his wife, Shirley Bavanese, is co-director and co-founder of the Relationship Institute in Royal Oak and Lavinia, Michigan. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you. Very honored to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you, as always. You have a reason for being particularly interested in trust issues in couples' relationships. Will you tell us what you've discovered at the Relationship Institute?
Sure. Yeah, we have been in business since 1993 for just under 17 years. And in the last 3 years, we've seen a tremendous rise in the number of people that present to couples therapy or marriage counseling with trust as one of the main issues that they're dealing with and struggling with. And it's been quite shocking to me. We used to hear people call in and say, my partner and I are arguing, or I feel distant, or things like that. And occasionally, you know, somebody would say there was a trust issue or an affair. But the percentage of those that we're seeing in the last few years has just skyrocketed.
Why do you think this is occurring?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the biggest reason is technology. I think that cell phones and the internet has made hiding contacts with people easier than before. And if somebody had an interest in someone else outside of their primary committed relationship, it's easier than ever to explore that in a secretive way. So number one, the technology makes it easier to do. Secondly, I think the nature of people's lives today, I see that couples are spending less time together in personal, you know, connection, quality time without the TV on or the computer on or something else distracting them. And so I think people have lost the sense of a deep connection with one another, which may create some openness for this. Another thing I think is going on, I think, you know, I hear a lot of couples saying that they feel like roommates. They feel distant, and they're missing the spark that brought them together. And the idea of somewhat innocently contacting someone new, whether it's someone at work or whether it's somebody online, can seem like a breath of fresh air to bring that spark back. And I think for most people, it starts off rather innocently and friendly. And then it goes from there. And then I think the last thing is that a lot of couples don't know how to discuss or resolve some of their frustrations or disappointments in their relationship. And so rather than communicating about it, they just act it out indirectly.
It's interesting. You're saying that couples are not making time for each other. They get busy with TV, with the internet, and a whole bunch of other activities and things like that, yet it sounds like they're beginning to make time for other people.
Yeah,
so
but they do it. Yeah,
go
but,
ahead.
But they do it, I was going to say, but they do it at work, or they do it, you know, when they're standing in line, you know, they're doing it with their phone and their texting and email and posting on Facebook and things like that. So it's not that they have to devote, you know, a lot of quality time. And if they do commit to some face-to-face time with somebody, it usually carries with it a tremendous amount of emotion and chemistry, you know, that they're willing to make time for.
So the grass looks greener on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, definitely. It looks greener and feels more intense, definitely.
Mm-hmm. I always think that when people tell me that, I say to them, well, the grass is greener where it's watered.
That's a great line. I like that. You know, Jen, there's an interesting thing. We we do a couples workshop 4 or 5 times a year, and one of the exercises that we teach couples is to do a daily communication exercise that takes 10 to 15 minutes a day. And I've gotten about a third of the couples each time we teach this will look at me incredulously and say, do you expect me to do that every day? You know, as if I've said spend 3 hours. And I look at them equally incredulously and say, are you telling me you don't have 10 minutes a day to devote to your relationship if it would be beneficial? And, you know, they honestly and sincerely feel it would be an imposition.
But they don't have 15 minutes a day to talk to each other about the things that are important.
Right, without any outside distraction, yeah. They have time to talk about their bills or their kids or their jobs, you know, or things like that, or what they're going to do next weekend. But when it comes to sitting down face-to-face with no distraction, with an exercise that they admit would probably be helpful in reconnecting on a deeper level, they find it hard to do.
Mm. You know, I have in front of me this article that I found about Facebook. It's not from Facebook, but it's about Facebook, talking about how these social sites can fuel divorce because of the ease with which people flirt in emails and send messages and things like that. And that's what you were saying earlier, too, that the opportunities now for hooking up with other people in a loose way are available.
Yeah, I just had a couple I saw yesterday, and the man had gotten a friend request on Facebook from an old girlfriend from college. He's now in his mid-30s. And he accepted the friend request, again, thinking, oh, I wonder what she's up to.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very flirtatious. And his wife was on his friend list, of course, or maybe I shouldn't say of course, but usually people do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so his wife said, gee, who's calling you honey? And, you know, making suggestive comments, who's that? And he embarrassedly said, oh, that's my old girlfriend from college. It's nothing. Well, of course, it didn't sound like nothing, and it caused a huge rift in their relationship. But I've heard that kind of a story, especially in the last year, about 25 times. And I've had people say that you have to get off Facebook if we're going to stay married.
Yes. And it sounds like it's hard to determine, for couples to determine whether or not this is a flirtation that was begun by the other person and it's really nothing and the spouse is not interested in it, or whether it's something that the spouse is reciprocating on.
Right, right. It is very hard to tell. And sometimes, you know, one person has one agenda and the other has the other, and it's not clear until there's been several communications. I've also seen the pattern, Jenny, where the same thing will happen with an ex, boyfriend, girlfriend, spouse, and the person will suddenly befriend their own spouse so that they don't read the posts, and suddenly someone will say, hey, I haven't seen any of your posts lately. You know, and again,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing, again, hiding. But I think, as I said, the ease at which someone can create, you know, a new email address or get a new cell phone or hide their text is just, you know, lends itself for people who have that predilection.
Well, what are some signs for partners to look out for problems?
Well, there's a couple of things. A big one, I find, I don't know if you've seen this, but has to revolve around their cell phones. You know, everybody has a cell phone these days, and
mm-hmm.
text messaging seems to be a primary way for people to communicate, whether they're having a flirtation, infatuation, or whether they're having an emotional affair, whether they're having a physical affair. And so one of the signs is that people either don't answer their phone or won't show you or talk about who's texting them when you're with them. It's a common thing to say, you know, oh, so-and-so just texted me or so-and-so called. But there's a reason why people don't answer certain calls, and there's a reason why, you know, people don't respond to certain text messages. So that's a big one, I find. Another sign is when a partner seems suddenly more distant than usual or is staying up a lot later than usual than they normally would go to bed. Another sign is when you walk in the room and they're on their computer, that they suddenly minimize what's on the screen in a hurry, as if they're hiding something. Those are some of the most common things. And obviously the most obvious sign is when you find some evidence of a text message, a voicemail, a Facebook posting that sounds much more suggestive, romantic, or sexual than friendly, which I guess we sort of had a more public illustration of this at the end of last year with the Tiger Woods story, where apparently he left a voicemail that many people heard that sort of unraveled that whole situation.
Yes, he really disappointed me.
Did he? Yeah.
Yes, he did. I used to tell people, yes, Tiger Woods and I share the same birthday, and now I don't want to tell people that.
Well, supposedly he's in treatment right now for a sex addiction, last I heard.
And I hope he does well.
Yeah. So those are some of the signs. But it's interesting with the cell phone thing. I was working with a couple 2 weeks ago, and the cell phone was the topic that the woman was concerned about. And that, you know, he hides it. And so I had mentioned to the man, he says, well, there's nothing going on, and I totally want her to trust me. And I said, well, why don't you just give her your phone right now and let her look through it? And he just looked at me glumly and said, I just can't do that. He had no good reason not to do it other than there was something there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I said a lot of this does revolve around cell phones.
So what can couples do when they're dealing with these types of trust issues?
Well, there's a lot of things they can do. I mean, if they're dealing with it, I guess there's a big difference if they're dealing with it with denial or whether they're dealing with it with openness. And in my experience, it doesn't become open until somebody gets caught, unfortunately. Very few people will come to their partner and say, guess what, I've been, you know, on the verge of having an affair, and let me show you the text messages to prove it. You know, what more commonly happens is somebody discovers something like that, and there's a big confrontation. So if there is a confrontation, or if you have a strong suspicion that something like this may be going on, you know, there's several things to do. But if you really are in a relationship where your partner wants to reestablish trust if it's been violated, then you really have to talk about ways to do that. You know, what are some specific things I could do, even if for a temporary time period? For example, some people will say, you can look at my phone, or I'll give you my password to my email, or I will, you know, call you and let you know where I am, you know, whenever you want me to. And things like that can help people get over, you know, the initial shock of it. But on a deeper level, what I think is necessary is really to go back to the deeper issue that's probably going on in the relationship that maybe caused the person to stray. You know, is there something missing? I don't find in every case there is something missing, but in a lot of cases it is, that someone's either angry or just feeling bored, just feeling like the relationship has gotten too routine, there's not enough excitement, and someone else offers the promise of excitement. So in that case, the couple really needs to learn, you know, how to communicate about their disappointments and their frustrations in a constructive way, how to resolve, you know, whatever conflicts from the past that may have caused a wedge between them, how to have not a roommate marriage or relationship, but one that's close and connected on a daily basis. Those are the kinds of things, you know, that, and lastly, you know, they have to break off all contact with this other person. What I find frequently happens is people will say, well, I haven't seen them. And I'll ask, well, have you sent any text messages? And they'll go, oh, yeah, about 30 a day, but I haven't seen them, so it's over.
Mm-hmm.
Or
emails. Is that not over?
Yeah, so, you know, it's not over if you're having any contact. And these things tend to be very addictive in nature. And people will say they have a hard time stopping it because it almost seems like they can't. Yes?
What do you mean by addictive in nature?
Meaning a lot of people will describe these types of relationships as almost that they've lost control at a certain point, that they couldn't stop communicating or seeing the person if they wanted to because the urge is so great. Even though it's irrational and even though they realize it's hurtful, they find it very difficult to stop the contact, and that even when they have tried to stop the contact or both people agree to stop the contact, one or more of them will break down and say, I just had to talk to you. I couldn't, you know, I can't go another day without talking to you. And so that's part of the problem is that people will say, you know, I have stopped all contact with that person. I've, you know, deleted their cell phone number. I've taken them off my friend list on Facebook. And then something happens and they see them again or have another message from them. And the reality is, as I said earlier, you can't stop all forms of contact with somebody. If they really want to contact somebody, there's always a way to hide it.
Sure.
But if people really want to develop trust, then they have to stop all forms of contact. And there may be a grieving period. There may have been a feeling of connection or companionship or friendship with that person, you know, that on some level seemed genuine, and they may feel like they've lost their best friend. But that's what they have to go through, to, you know, to reconnect with their primary partner if that's their goal.
You're talking a lot about how they're feeling, and they talk a lot about how they're feeling, but they don't seem to be talking about what they value.
No, that seems to be rationalized away. What I hear people say is, it feels so good. It feels like I've met, you know, the perfect person. I feel like this person understands me. You know, I feel so much happier when I'm with them or have contact with them, or, you know, they actually listen to me. And then when you ask them about their values, if they think this is right, they will almost always say, no, I that's one of the conflicts I have, that sometimes I feel guilty about it, but I just can't stop.
We started to touch on this, but what things do you believe has to happen to restore trust? And is there a process, a step-by-step process? Or
Yeah, I find there is a step-by-step process. I mean, you know, a lot of people really do need the help of a good therapist to help them through it, because it is a hard thing to manage on your own. I mean, the initial stage, you know, when the thing is revealed, what's going on is usually characterized by a lot of anger on the part of the other person, and there may be a lot of distancing and, you know, don't come near me, and just a lot of venting of anger. And the person who had the breach of trust has to be willing to, you know, support and accept and understand that stage. And then the second stage after that is working through in a more constructive way, you know, the feelings of hurt, the feelings of betrayal, the feelings of resentment that are present as you're building trust, as you're working on ways to find, you know, to start rebuilding the trust. And then the third stage is what I said earlier, is that you have to go back and look at, you know, what was missing. One of the paradoxically wonderful thing that I have seen in working with couples about affairs, even though they tend to be very painful for many people, of course, is that it forces people who work through it to examine the relationship in fine detail, very thoroughly, and they almost always will say to me at the end of therapy that they wouldn't wish this on their worst enemy, but it was the best thing that ever happened to their marriage because they will no longer take anything for granted. And it's true. Most of the people that do that have a closer, happier, more communicative, more open, and more connected relationship.
I bet one of the things that, well, there's a couple things that have to happen to make that all work, and one is the person who was violating the trust to be willing to be accountable.
Yes.
You know, to be willing to show them their partner the cell phone, to be willing to not minimize things on the computer, to let the partner have access to their emails and all that, so that there's complete openness and accountability for their actions.
Right. Definitely.
And I know that some people...
Yeah, I was going to say that's part of the problem because there's usually, obviously, if someone's capable of doing this, they're capable of denial and lying and hiding. And frequently what happens is it's a repetitive process, as they'll say, you know, no, I haven't talked to this person. And then some new information will come out or some new text message will be revealed that was even more upsetting than the last one. You know, and that's where the person starts to begin to build up trust and then they go all the way back down to nothing and it's very, very devastating.
And then they wonder if it's worth going back through the process of, again, of attempting to rebuild trust.
Right. It's then, you know, should I be vulnerable, open myself up again when this has now happened two times or three times? And it's very hard to get the emotional strength to do that when it just feels like you may be setting yourself up. And the other thing that's interesting, Jenny, and I would be interested in your ideas about this, is that a lot of people will say to me, I never thought I was the type of person who would do this. You know, they almost seem genuinely surprised that they're in the situation, that they never would have thought of themselves as somebody who was capable of some form of cheating or hiding or infidelity. And they really seem like, you know, like, who is this person doing this? You know, like, it's not me. And they do feel like, again, getting back to the values question, this is not something that I would have ever said, and I've always said to my partner, you know, that I would never do that, and if I ever did, I would tell you, which, of course, no one ever does.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that I see is that when we have been with someone for a long time, we do get into routines, and things can begin to feel, like you said earlier, boring. And then let's say that you meet somebody at work, the opposite gender, and maybe you decide to have lunch together. And that's pretty innocent. You have lunch together.
Yeah.
And then, well, maybe then you go out for a drink after work.
Yeah.
And then maybe you start doing that more frequently. And then you maybe start talking about the problems that you're having with your spouses or saying, you know, things are boring and we just not getting along the way we used to. And it's just this gradual process of getting closer, straying farther and farther away from what you value and closer to this excitement and this feeling. So it's such a gradual process for some people that they do get surprised that they get from point A to point B. And they have a hard time tracking how that happened.
Yeah. But what I always tell people is, you know, there is a point in the development of these types of relationships where you clearly know that something is developing that is
emotional. And you have a choice.
Yeah, and that's the choice point. In other words, you do have a choice of whether to keep feeding it or whether to starve it at that point. And most people will say, you know, well, it's too late for that now. Now that I've come to see you, it's because I can't manage it. Or I didn't realize how important this person had become to me, you know, until recently. So there does seem to be a lot of denial that goes along with this whole thing. And even though, you know, people even say to me, you know, I feel like I'm on the Titanic. Someone said to me recently, I feel like there's no way this is going to end well, and sooner or later there's going to be a massive amount of pain, but I'm going to enjoy the ride until that happens.
Mm-hmm. Do you notice that, I was making a note about something that you had said. See if I can find it again. Nope, I lost it.
Okay.
But I can go on to something else that I've been thinking about here. Now I know what it is. In terms of openness and accountability, I've heard spouses say, I feel like I'm back in kindergarten where I have to tell, you know, my mommy and daddy everything I'm doing, and I have no sense of privacy anymore. Nothing is private, and, you know, I like my sense of privacy, and here you want me to be a totally open book. But I think in that healing process, at least for a certain period of time, you give up that right to your privacy and need to be an open book in order to restore that trust.
Yeah, that's what I tell people. You created this. you have made certain decisions, taken certain actions that have created the situation, and if you sincerely want to get through it, then for a temporary period of time, that is how you need to act.
And I also have discovered that when couples start to spend more time together, that helps to rebuild the trust, because when I can see you and I see what you're doing, I know what you're doing and I know you're here, then that's a moment of my life in which I can trust you. And the more moments I have in my life that I can trust you, that helps me with the process of building the trust when you're not there.
Yeah. But what I find is the most difficult thing is if it's somebody, for example, that they see at work, or they see at a particular meeting they go to at work in a particular building or something like that, and the partner knows that today's the day they're doing that. You know, those
mm-hmm.
kind of things where you know, even being together, you know, doesn't help so much. Although I do find even in those situations, sometimes it just helps to call, you know, before they go to that meeting and say, I love you, just want to know I'm thinking about you. That can take all the anxiety away from someone, you know, who's struggling with it. So. But it's, you know, these relationships, I just want to say another thing about this denial. I mean, what I'm always sort of puzzled by is the degree of irrationality that people will risk so much of what they've worked for and for these relationships. And even though, you know, they clearly know how dangerous and risky they are, they just seem to rationalize that, you know, I guess this is sort of the grandiosity that goes along with it, that no one will find out, I'm clever enough to hide this, or even, and maybe this was the case of a Tiger Woods level of success, you know, this is what I deserve as a perk for my success, but people do remarkably irrational and dangerous things for the sake of these types of relationships.
My inclination is to ask, why?
That's a good question. I mean, I wonder that all the time. I you know, I see people who risk their professional reputation, their whole family, and, you know, I don't think people have a good answer. The only answer I come up with is I think people have lost the experience of feeling alive to such a degree in their busy adult lives. And this feels so alive and so much in the present moment that it's an experience that they're just not willing to let go of and give up. It's sort of like Thoreau's famous line that the majority of people lead lives of quiet desperation, and these relationships are neither quiet nor desperate. They are alive, and they feel in full living color, and I think people don't know how to feel that way, you know, in their daily lives, and so they end up, you know, pursuing these very dangerous, irrational things.
So one of the things, once this all comes out, one of the ways of bringing that excitement back home is to really take a look at your partner and remember what you first saw in them and the romance that was there, and not necessarily bringing back that old romance, but taking a look at how can I water the grass on my side of the fence. What can I do and what can my partner do? What can we do together to have greener grass?
Thinking metaphorically. Yeah, that's a great point. One of the things I think I was listening, I don't know if you know anything by Frank Pittman, the psychiatrist who does a lot of work with couples, and he writes articles about infidelity a lot. But he was saying that he feels a lot of this has to do with the sort of the self-centeredness and immaturity of a lot of people. And he says that marriage is your last best chance to grow up, and that, you know, if you are waiting, when I hear this too, you know, caring behaviors are the best way to generate, you know, more chemistry and more closeness and more positive feelings toward each other. But a lot of people will say, well, when I feel loved, then I will do something for you. And they're hearkening back to that first stage of romantic love or infatuation when basically most of us just have to show up and we feel tremendously wonderful. And people are more thoughtful, more giving, more spontaneous. But then after that stage ends, you only get those feelings by small repeated acts of kindness and thoughtfulness, and then you generate those. But I think a lot of people get to the point, if they're resentful, if they're disappointed, if they're hurt, they get to a point where they wait and say, you know, if you make me feel good, then I'll do something. And that's just a recipe for things to get worse.
Waiting for the other person to make the first move.
Yeah, right.
That's another way of also saying, I'm due this or you owe me this.
Yeah,
Rather than I'm responsible for helping in this relationship. I'm responsible for the things that I can do.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, it becomes a blame game. Well, if only you, well, if only you, well, if only you, and then
it escalates,
gets out of control.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where the anger comes in, too, and the hurt feelings.
Yep. Yeah, and then I think, you know, people end up, you know, the stages they go from the anger and then they just get distant and apathetic. And I see a lot of these relationships start at that point where people are, you know, bored or distant or apathetic, and then they don't particularly see any way to resurrect those feelings with their current partner. And they really feel stuck, and they feel like, and then this other person comes in their life and, you know, suddenly the birds are singing, and it's very hard to compare the two. I mean, it's
sure.
not fair to compare the two, but, you know, they do it in their mind.
Do you find in working with the couples that you see that there is a consistent kind of something that happens that turns the tide back towards the relationship?
Oh, yeah, I do. I find that, you know, if and when the person, you know, finds out what's going on with somebody else and they make a commitment to working through it, the thing that turns the tide is they sort of get back into reality in their mindset and they suddenly grasp what was at stake and what they almost lost. And when I find when people really get that, they suddenly work very hard at creating the best relationship they can and being the best partner they can, because they suddenly realize, you know, that what they almost threw away was very precious and special, and that they were really, really taking it for granted.
This may not be a fair question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyways.
That's
how
okay.
How long does it take to restore trust?
Well, it's a fair question. I mean, I think it obviously depends on the depth of the betrayal. If, you know, somebody finds a text message on your phone that says, you know, something sexual or something loving, you know, that can be dealt with in, you know, 2 hours. If somebody's had an affair for years, that's going to probably take over a year or two to kind of get through. So it just depends on the depth. If you knew the person, you know, things like that, and what form it took. You know, sometimes I think the most threatening relationship is one that's not only physical but also emotional, where an emotional bond has occurred. I know one of the somebody I had read about affairs a long time ago said most affairs are a lot of talking and a little sex, and that the primary thing was the companionship and feeling like someone paid attention and listened to you. So to the extent that that happens, you know, that's more of a threat, because that's really meeting some emotional need that tends to go deeper than the physical.
In the healing process, one of the things that I've observed is that the person who broke the trust, let's say that they become trustworthy, they really clean up their act, and they are acting with integrity, and they say, okay, you know, I'm trustworthy now, so trust me. And the partner is saying, you know, I'm not there yet. I can't trust you. I'm not in your head. I'm not walking around. I don't know it for sure. I still don't fully believe it, and I need more time. And I noticed the frustration that the person who has restored being trustworthy struggling with the person who doesn't yet.
I see that commonly. And the dynamic I see it most frequently was if the man is the one, you know, who has strayed and will kind of work hard at this for a finite period of time and then get impatient and say something mm-hmm. like, are we still talking about this? So mm-hmm. what I tell couples at the outset of this kind of work is I tell them what to expect. And I will say to the man in that situation is that, you know, you're going to have to work hard at restoring trust. And we don't know yet how long this will take or what form it will take. We'll know by the way she reacts and responds to what we're doing. But you have to let her be the guide, because it's not a linear process. It's not a simple, you know, do this, this, and this, and we'll all get better and go away. And, you know, some men have a hard time understanding that, because they're thinking, you know, that this should go away in 2 weeks or a month if they just do a couple of things. And they don't, usually though, in that case, I find that the men don't really get the depth of the hurt, and they don't really understand, you know, how upsetting it was. And I find if you can help them, you know, communicate about that, that usually helps them have more patience for however long the process is going to take.
So men have to do something that is more difficult for men to do, and that's to communicate clearly their feelings and being empathic with their spouse. You know, I understand that if you take all the men in the world and you take the median of the men, that they tend not to be talkers about their feelings. They're more action-oriented. I will show you rather than I will talk about it, and the woman is saying, I want to talk about it.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. And I think that's, you know, and a lot of men who are more problem solvers, you know, they think a problem has a beginning and an end, and
right.
They will have a hard
problem.
Time. Yeah, and it tends to be more behavioral in their mind. So, and then the other thing that's hard is that there's a point at which in the process of healing from this, you know, that the man, in the beginning, the man is sort of scapegoated and has to sort of accept that role as having caused this. And when you get to that third stage I was describing, then you can look at the dynamics between them and see what the other person was doing that may have contributed, you know, to the distance or the lack of conflict resolution. And then there's an opportunity for the other person to express some of their frustration. You know, because some of this will linger. I mean, I was just working with a couple on Tuesday where a couple's been dealing with something since last February, almost a year now, and it's pretty much resolved. But once in a while it flares up, and the guy gets very angry whenever it does. You know, to him it just seems so irrational. He said, you know, I haven't done anything. My life's an open book, and you're still holding on to this. And she's not holding on to it, but once in a while something will happen that just reminds her, and she'll have a hard time. You know, and it can be watching a movie. You know, so many movies and so many TV shows involve some form of infidelity that mm-hmm. it's hard for couples recovering from this not to be constantly reminded of it. So,
or even the commercials on TV.
Yeah, exactly. So it's hard for a lot of men, you know, to hold the space for the healing process to really go from beginning to end. And, you know, what I tell them is if you really do this with presence and attention and patience, you know, you'll get to the other side, you'll have a better relationship, and you won't have to revisit this again. But on the other hand, if you express frustration with the process or the speed, you know, you're not going to have a complete resolution, and the issue is going to stay around for a long time.
One of the things I think we've inadvertently done is made the man the bad guy, like he's the one who always breaks the trust, but it also women break this trust too.
Right, obviously.
It's not
yeah.
just the guy. Yeah.
Right, obviously.
We have spoken a lot about men breaking the trust.
Right. But I have found that I think women are more understanding of the men, the pain the men are going through. Although, one interesting thing, though, is I think when a woman has some breach of trust, you know, men respond to it quite differently in my experience. The men don't want to know the details. They would just as well sort of deny it and just, you know, try to go get past it, or just have more of a black or white, all or nothing response to it. Whereas women want to know a lot of the details of how did it start, you know, so that they can feel some security that it won't happen again. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's the way men deal with it. I think men are embarrassed that they, you know, they see it almost as an affront to their adequacy or their masculinity or even their intelligence that this could have happened and that they didn't know it. And a lot of men, I find, have a very hard time getting over it just for that reason, because they, you know, they'll say to me, I'll never let anybody, you know, make a fool of me again like that. And that's really how they perceive it.
Okay. Do you have anything more that to say about this, you know, what couples can do to deal with these type of issues?
Yeah, one of the things.
I have another question, but
yeah,
I want to make sure we're finishing this up.
Sure. I wanted to mention two books that I think are helpful.
Okay.
For relationships that start at work, there's a good book by Shirley Glass, who's now deceased. She's the mother, actually, of Ira Glass, who does the radio show This American Life, some people may know. But she had specialized her whole practice in affairs and infidelity. And 2 years before she died, she wrote a book called Not Just Friends. And in that book, she talks about how relationships outside of the home can actually be, you know, in some level a threat to your primary relationship if you're not conscious of it. So, for example, she recommends things like don't have lunch with somebody one-on-one, or even don't have meetings in your office privately with a member of the opposite sex. And her point being is that if you never do that, there's no possible way anything can get started. So
mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a moderately paranoid defensive approach to it. But I think she has a lot of good points just about how especially office kinds of romances can get started. And then the book by Janice Abrams called After the Affair, I think is another good book for couples struggling with this. And there's also a lot of good stuff online, but I like those two books especially.
And the second author was Janice.
Oh, Abrams, A-B-R, I think it's H-M-S, yeah.
Okay. I will add them to the email that I send out with the link to the recording of the Yes, because everyone will get that, even those who are participating actively online now, are listening actively right now. Let's talk about prevention.
Okay.
How can we prevent this from happening? How can we prevent trust from breaking?
Yeah, good point. Well, I think that the best way to prevent this is to have, you know, a close, loving relationship. I think people are much less likely, you know, to be open to something like this developing, or at least if they do see it developing, they will recognize the signs and, you know when to back away from it. So, I mean, I think if there's any insurance policy or inoculation against affairs, it's, you know, to have a close, loving relationship and really understand the value of that in your life. now and in the future, and to recognize, really think through the consequences. I mean, one of the things, as I said before, about the massive denial people have, I mean, most people have no idea of the amount of hurt that this is going to cause when they take that step, because they're just not thinking, you know, clearly and rationally. But so I think, you know, anybody who is even contemplating the beginning of anything like this, you know, you really have to think through what it's going to mean and usually turn toward your partner rather than away if there's something that you're feeling you're not getting or you're missing or that's not working in your life. But I think that's by far the best prevention.
One of the things that we do for our jobs and our careers are continuing education, or is continuing education. What about ongoing relationship education for couples, whatever the stage of their relationship?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, I always believe you can never learn too much about, you know, healthy relationships. Everybody, what I love about studying relationships is that everybody sort of has a different angle on it, and you know, you always learn something new from different presenters and different workshop experiences and different therapists. So I think that's a great idea to, you know, continually learn. And also I think hanging around other couples that have good relationships, you know, it sort of models it for you, that it's possible. You know, some single people I work with in therapy will say, you know, why even bother? I don't even know anybody that's happy in a relationship. And there are plenty of people that are very happy. And if you spend time with them, you know, some of that modeling will rub off on you. And it's I think it's very inspirational.
I think that's a really good point. You mentioned earlier in the call that at the Relationship Institute, you do several couples workshops a year. Could you tell us about that? I understand you have one coming up soon.
Yeah, we have one. We always do one around Valentine's Day. Saturday, February 13th, in our Royal Oak, Michigan office, we have an all-day workshop called Passage to Intimacy, based on the PAIRS program. And we really see it as a skill-building day where we teach couples specific communication, conflict resolution, and re-romanticizing tools that are very practical that they can apply in their life, you know, literally the day they go home. So I find this is sort of a missing piece in our culture, is that the relationship education that most of us get as teenagers and young adults is pretty poor and misleading. And I think that the myth of romantic love still pervades our culture, and people don't know what to expect. People don't know how to communicate. People don't know how to resolve conflict, and they don't know how to get close, you know, after there's been some kind of an impasse. So those are some of the skills that we teach in these workshops that we do.
And what kinds of couples would you recommend these workshops for, or to?
Oh, these workshops are good for either a couple who, I mean, you know, it could be quite a wide variety, actually. I mean, sometimes we will get couples that are engaged and very happy and saying, I just want to learn everything I can to give us the best chance to succeed, which I always love to see those people, of course, because they're being very proactive and preventive. Then we'll get couples that have been married a long time and and are feeling the distant roommate kind of a thing and just want to find a way to reconnect, or they know they have things to resolve but they just can't talk about them. And then, you know, there's also couples in varying degrees of crisis, you know, that have an issue and they know they need help in resolving it, and they prefer a workshop format to going to a marriage counselor, because they want to learn some good tools for communication. The only couples that are really inappropriate for this type of workshop are those where the level of conflict is explosive, you know, or even violent, where they're verbally abusive on almost a daily basis, where they can't contain, you know, the anger or the rage that they're feeling. And, you know, it's not appropriate for someone in that situation. But mostly what we do is we teach a skill. They practice it alone with their partner in a large group room, and then they come back as a group, and we answer questions. But that's the format, and then we just build a skill set throughout the whole day.
This is truly educational workshop as opposed to psychotherapy.
Yes, definitely. Psychoeducational in nature, where they're learning skills and tools and given guidance on how to use them and why to use them and when to use them. And then they get to, discuss, they get to try them out right there and then bring up any questions or problems that occur. One of the interesting things in those workshops is that, people will find out that, again, without sounding too stereotypical, but a common thing is that women will say that their husbands don't talk enough, and then they learn in the workshop that one of the reasons they don't talk enough is that they interrupt them whenever they start talking. And when they actually, take the time to listen, and the guys feel safe, they actually have quite a bit to say. So that's always interesting to see that dynamic, because, before the workshop, the women are saying, hopefully this workshop will help my husband open up and, talk to me more. And you find out they do that if you're able to listen.
If you're quiet for a while.
Yeah.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the workshop that you're doing, this Passage to Intimacy, can be valuable to most couples unless their arousal and their problems are so high that they're just not available to look at each other and talk about it.
Yeah.
familiar with your program, and I'm familiar with pairs, and anybody in your area who's listening, I highly recommend that you go for it, that you do it. And also, it's great value for your dollar, because when you go for marriage counseling, the amount that you pay per session versus the amount that you pay for the workshop, there's no comparison.
Yeah, you can, in one day you can get an entire, set of tools that, sometimes we do teach them in sessions privately, and that can take, 10 sessions to learn the same thing you'll do in one day.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's a good point.
So just as I'm making up a number, but if a session is $100 and you take 10 sessions, that's $1,000, and you're not charging $1,000 for this day-long workshop.
No, it's $295 per couple for the whole day. And
we even offer
a guarantee on that. So,
what's your guarantee?
Well, what we tell couples is that take the workshop and apply the tools that we're teaching you for 6 months, and at the end of 6 months, if you feel it hasn't helped your marriage, then we'll refund your money. So,
if my information is correct, the people who will be leading this workshop are you and your wife Shirley and Thad Zarimba.
Thad Zarimba, yes.
Thad Zarimba is going to be speaking with us next Wednesday afternoon, and he's going to be talking specifically about relationship education and workshops.
Oh, good,
so
we've been doing these workshops together for the specific version of this workshop for about 10 years, so we've done it, probably 40 times or so, and so Thad's a great person to talk about it.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy, and he makes you laugh.
Yeah, he's a very funny guy, and he's always got people laughing, and I think that helps break up the seriousness of some of the topics that we have to process in those workshops.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, Joe, and what I'd like to all our listeners to do is to take a few minutes after we end this call to write down 1 to 3 of the most valuable takeaway points that you've had from Joe, the points that you've made, and then write down what 1 small step is that you will take to start a chain reaction towards rebuilding or improving trust with your partner or even with somebody else in your life. It may be difficult to remember everything that Joe said about trust in couples' relationships, so later today, everyone's going to receive an email with a link to a replay of the call, and that you can listen to it again, and you can review what you heard and pick up on whatever it is that you missed the first time around. And like I said, Thad is going to be speaking with us next Wednesday, also at 1 o'clock. And then in terms of the information about your pair's workshop, your Passage to Intimacy, the people who are online now can see those links, but I'll also include them in the email that I'm sending folks.
Good. Thank you.
And on Monday night, we will be hearing from Dr. James Moss and his colleague Rebecca Robbins on what sleep has to do with relationships. And you're going to go, huh, what's the connection there? Well, be on the call and hear, because they have a wonderful, compelling presentation style. Dr. Moss is the world's leading sleep educator and researcher. He's from Cornell University, and you're likely to be surprised by all the ways that sleep impacts relationships. He's just incredible, and you might find it interesting, Joe, that he went to Cranbrook to school.
Oh, really?
Near you. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, right now. That's good. And I also know you're having Brian Farr talk about money.
And money, yep.
Couples. Yeah, he's someone I know, and he's done a great job in helping people understand how the relationship with money, you know, affects the quality of the relationship, and he's a great speaker, and I'm sure that will also be a very, very good one to tune into.
And the other one we are having is on addictions, relationships that are traumatized by the chaos of addictions, and a woman from the Gottman Institute will be speaking on that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so I'm looking at...
Great lineup, Jenny. I want to thank you for organizing this. It's a great service to the people in the community and in the country and the world who can tune in, because it's a great lineup of very important topics. Relationships are challenging and difficult, and I think we all need to hear all the good knowledge and wisdom that we can find. Thank you.
We need to share. And, Joe, I thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know this is now 3 hours of conference calls that you've done in a row.
And I have two more.
And you have two more. You're going to be very tired talking. You're sharing your time and your gift and your expertise as a gift to all of us, and we'll continue to create healthy relationships that can contribute to creating healthy relationships that can last a lifetime.
Okay, thank you.
So thank you. And everybody, have a good rest of the day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.
The moderator has left the conference.